The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
A grace that characterizes our fathers who established his kingdom is the grace of courage. That resoluteness of mind and spirit that in face of opposition enabled them to stand and to withstand. Abraham had that grace. When he went up against the four kings of Mesopotamia with only 318 of his household servants and delivered his relative Lot from the hand of the enemy. Moses displayed that grace when he contested with the Pharaoh and gave birth to the kingdom of God, and it sustained him throughout the wilderness. David had this ability to stand and withstand great opposition, and when he assumed the kingdom, it was on the point of annihilation. The Philistines had established prefects and garrisons in the very heart of land of Israel, in the central ridge in Bethlehem and Shiloh and so forth. They had their foot right there when he had assumed the monarchy. And yet, in spite of tremendous opposition, through this grace of God's Spirit upon him, he overthrew the Philistine, the Edomite, the Aramean, and insurrection within his own realm. And in the Psalter, we are given an insight into the means of this grace, the truths that he laid hold of that enabled him to have courage, that he didn't abdicate, didn't quit, didn't throw in the towel, but persevered in his faith. Psalm 139 is born out of a context as adversity. You'll see that in the petition section where he says in verse 19, "Away from me, you bloodthirsty men." And in one of these crises of opposition, surrounded by murderers that seek to wipe him out, he lays hold of great truths about God, as he does throughout the Psalter, that enables him to stand firm, to triumph, and to prevail. He moved out, he conquered, because he knew great truths about his God. And there are two in particular that he lays hold of in this psalm, and at the end he lays hold of a basic truth about himself that we may apply to our own lives, that if we find ourselves fearful, anxious, looking for perimeters of security, unwillingness to launch out into new areas to be victorious from God, that we can learn from David, and we too can lay hold of these great attributes of God and make them our own in our own situation today, whatever our situation may be. We need not be afraid. We can be triumphant. The psalm, as you're aware, is 24 verses long, and it falls into four stanzas with six verses in each stanza. The first stanza, he lays hold of God's omniscience about him. God, you know me. That's verses 1 through 6. In the second stanza, verses 7 through 12, he lays hold of God's attribute of omnipotence, God's omnipresence. God, you are with me. God, you know me. God, you are with me. In the next stanza, in verses 13 through 18, he gives the evidence for these attributes. And here he operates something like a natural theologian. He looks at the creation, at his own creation, and having seen how God made him, he drew these conclusions that God, you know me and you are with me. And finally, at the end, in the petition section of the psalm itself, he lays hold and strives to lay hold of a basic truth about himself. God, I'm your man. By your grace, you won me to your side, and your enemies are my enemies. Harriet Lovett, in her doctoral dissertation on Psalm 139, a dissertation written at Columbia University, shows that each of these stanzas furthermore falls into 4 and 2 verses. The last 2 verses give you a little different switch each time than in the first part of the stanza. Let us make just brief comment as we look at the first stanza, in which he lays hold of this great truth about God: God, you know me. In typical Semitic style, he gives us a summary statement in the introductory verse, and then in the rest of it, he elaborates, he epexegetes it, he develops the summary statement. He states it very clearly in verse 1, O Lord, you have searched me out, the Hebrew word hakar, indicating something that's difficult. It's difficult to penetrate, but God has probed right to his basic character. He has unraveled him to his very basic heart as to who he is. You've searched me out, and you know me. Now he develops that in verse 2 through a series of synecdoches called merisms, stating of opposites. He says, you know me all the time. There's never a moment when you're not conscious of me and knowing me. You know when I sit, when I arise. And even though you are in heaven and I'm on earth, constantly throughout the day, you know me, even as God knew us throughout the night. And he knew us when we got up this morning. He knows us while we're here. He'll know you in the classroom. He'll know you at work. He'll know you in your home. That whatever situation that you happen to be in, God knows you in that situation. Let us not have a God that's too small. Everything God touches has almost the fingerprint of infinity upon it. The stars are uncountable. The cells in our bodies are in the trillions. What man makes is so finite and easily deducible, but what God touches has infinity. So let us not be stumbled by our spiritual God knowing 4 billion people every second of the day. That is a small number compared to the creation. He knows each of us personally in our experiences. Furthermore, he says, not only do you know me all the time, you know me wherever I may be, from my most public moments to my most private affairs, at verse 3. You discern my going out and my lying down, and the lying down is the Hebrew word here for coitus. You know me in my most personal, intimate moments. You also know when I'm abroad and I'm a most public figure, so whether you're in a public life or in private life, God knows you. Before the word is even on my tongue, and I'm even to articulate what I'm going to do, you, the omniscient God, know the whole of it already, even before I have articulated it. In the last 2 verses of the stanza, he switches somewhat, and this warm feeling almost becomes cold as he realizes the truth. This knowledge of God is inescapable, that you might want a half an hour of your day privately when God didn't know you, and he realizes there is not, you do not have that option. There's never a moment God is not conscious of you that makes us accountable for every second of our lives. 5 and 6, you hem me in with this knowledge behind and before. You've laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too awesome for me. It's too lofty. I'm no match for it. The idea here is it's an inaccessible height. I can never overwhelm. It's like a high-soaring mountain that I can never overcome. And I'm no match for it because I'm just finite man. And you are infinite God. Now he speaks of God's omnipresence. He says it in a summary statement in verse 7 as he leads the second paragraph. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? And the answer is no place. First of all, he looks at on the vertical axis. If I go up to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. And this merism, this opposite of heaven and Sheol, is not only a quantitative difference, it's a qualitative difference. Whether I'm in the place of bliss in heaven, where at your right hand there are pleasures forevermore, or whether I'm in Sheol itself, where there's chaos, sterility, and death, it is qualitatively different. whether I'm in the place of blessing or I'm in the place of death and despair and difficulty, that makes no difference. You are there, so that whatever situation you may be in, good or bad, God is present with you. And then he looks at it on a horizontal axis. If I fly with the speed of light, is the way he puts it in verse 9, if I rise on the wings of the dawn in the east, if I settle on the far side of the sea, and in the ancient Near Eastern thinking, the east where the sun rose, that was the place of life. The west where the sun set in the sea, that was the place of death. As in Egypt, you know, the temples to the gods of life are always on the east side of the Nile. The tombs of death are always on the west side of the Nile. So he's thinking on the horizontal plane, not only on a quantitative axis, as east is the west, but on a qualitative axis from the place of life to the place. Even if I change my state and I put myself in utter darkness, you're going to be there holding me in this black, crushing darkness. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me. By the way, the word here, hide, in Hebrew is the same word for the crushing of the head and the crushing of the heel, that you're in such a place of darkness you feel crushed and bruised is the picture that's at stake here. You feel utterly bruised and battered in your dark situation. The light will, and the light now has become darkness upon me. Even the darkness will be not be too dark for you. The night will shine like the day, but darkness is as the light to you. Note the four that begins verse 13, because now he's going to show the basis for this kind of thinking. And he looks at God as the creator. We would move beyond it, for God has revealed himself in his Son, Jesus Christ, who has said, lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. But here David looks at his creation summary statement. You created my inmost being, the Hebrew word here, kiliopi, in the kidneys, referring to his emotional structure. It's a synecdoche. Of course, it doesn't come off very well in a translation. You created my kidneys. Doesn't come off very well. So, but of course, in King James, if you say you possess my reins, R-E-I-N-S, and use the French word for kidneys, it sounds good. Nobody knows what it means, but it sounds nice. But he means by this, you created my whole emotional structure. You know whether I'm high-strung or whether I'm unstrung. It makes no difference. You created me. You knit me together in my mother's womb. This is a tremendous text dealing with abortion to show that the fetus is not a biological accident of history, and it's not just so much tissue. God is intimately involved forming that fetus from the conception to throughout the gestation period to the time of parturition from the womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. So that in the creation of ourselves, in our very creation, we are given some indication of God's awesome knowledge. And that he's there in the dark, watery chambers involved in the processes of life shows that darkness is no barrier to the creator. He produces his magnum opus, if you please, in a studio where there are no windows whatsoever. In utter darkness, he produces man. And around us, we see this image of God and the human personality with motions, as Schaefer would put it, of rationality and morality. I was reading recently Whittaker Chambers' Confessions and his autobiography, what converted him from atheistic communism, and he walked away from atheistic communism to the expose of Alger Hiss. The decisive moment was as he was looking at his two-year-old daughter in a high chair studying her ear, and he realized this could not be the chance product of an impersonal universe. Verse 15, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my embryo. And then he uses ancient Near Eastern thought, when a king was born, there was a book of destiny that spelled out his days. So also he had a book of destiny given to him by his God. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. In the last two stanzas, he puts together in a beautiful juxtaposition this strange point, that something that is so infinite usually becomes common and trite and of no value. But God's thoughts, though infinite, each one is extremely precious. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God! How vast is the sum of them! What a strange juxtaposition that this is infinite and yet and relatively infinite, and yet each one is precious in its own terms. What a heritage! Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. And now he leaves the state of meditation and contemplation and his point of confidence When I awake, I am still with you. He uses the same vocabulary as Jeremiah will use. As Jeremiah left the state of prophetic vision and came back to the real world, David is now in transition from the state of contemplation and comes to the real world where there are murderers all around him. Here is Sheol. Here is the uttermost parts of the sea. Here's the hard reality of history. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They are not lovers of God. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. They violate the third commandment. And then he seeks to lay hold of a truth about himself. Do not I hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you. I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. But then in the last two verses, he doesn't see himself as a cardboard figure with just a white hat. He's well aware that we often are great figures, and he wants to make sure he's the kind of man he's professing to be in order that he might have confidence. And he lays himself totally open before God, that God would make clear to him any sin in his life that would impede the divine operations of grace in him. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my disquieting thoughts, that I might have full confidence with you. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. So let us too live our lives openly before God, unafraid to allow him to show us the sin in our lives, that we might confess it. Let us not be ambivalent about this. There is God's grace and this perfect forgiveness, and that we can be sure that we are God's people, unafraid. And unafraid to face the challenges that he would put before us, that we might take the world for him.